part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
And so is it Brian Level or Lavelle or
it's Level.
Level. Okay, great.
But I don't get funny about it. It's fine.
No, I mean, I just wanted to make sure, you know, it's because
I appreciate it.
Sometimes there is a simple pronunciation. There seems to be a simple pronunciation to a name, and then it gets fancy on me. So I just wanted to get it right.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever been accused of being fancy, so there will.
Well, there's a first timer, and the part-time fanboy podcast could be that thing. We could change
I'll
Lavelle.
Take it.
What's that?
I'll take it. You know, there is a weird bloodthirsty history with my name, so maybe we'll get into that at some point.
Yeah, we can get into that. Well, why don't we just start by saying that this is the part-time fanboy podcast. My name is Christian Horn. And I have a very special guest on the line. His name is Brian Level. And he has, I like to get started, you know, whenever anyone's crowdfunding, which seems to be a lot lately on this podcast, I like to just tell people, you know, right off the bat why you're here so that they can go and fund your project. And the project that you have is called The Brothers James, and it is currently on Zoop, which is a new crowdfunding, kind of new crowdfunding platform, at least to me. Have I got it right so far?
You have. They're a couple of months old, I think, at this point.
They're only a couple of months old, really?
A couple of babies, yeah. They, I think their first project launched maybe in June.
Oh, really?
I'm not 100% certain.
Oh, so I'm not a complete ignoramus. Like they're completely new and I just hadn't heard about them recently. Oh, that's great. Because I did interview one other Zoop creator fundraiser like a couple of weeks ago. And to me, it was brand new. And I was just like, oh, am I just a dumb guy that's never not heard of this yet? But I'm glad to know that I'm not the dumb guy. But why don't you introduce yourself to listeners or, you know, let's talk about the Brothers James. I mean, I had a chance to read the second issue.
If you ever want any other issues, feel free to.
I'm gonna go in and support your project. That's how much I liked it. Usually these days, like I said, there's so many crowdfunding projects that I kind of tend to stick with the digital versions because I'm a cheapskate sometimes. And there's so
sure.
many projects.
Well, there's just a lot of projects.
It's a lot of projects. I'm not gonna lie. There are definitely times where I'm just like, oh my gosh, there's a lot of projects and I'm throwing a lot of money at digital comics because I like to support the creators that, come on, it's not a bribe. I do, after reading the second issue, I want to support your project. That's how much I liked it.
Yeah, well, that's flattering because that was the first issue that I drew, actually.
Oh, really? So yeah, that was the one thing I wanted to ask about because there's a bunch of different names on this project. And you are the gentleman who was nice enough to come onto my podcast and talk to me out of, I think, the three names. So are you're a co-writer and an artist on the book?
I am. I'll try to keep this oral history of the Brothers James pretty abbreviated. But I took over. So there's a list of names. And I will say, it's not that nobody's not nice enough to come on your show. That just everybody's in weird places in their lives right now.
Sure, no. I was making a joke.
I guess it's funny because Ryan Ferrier is the primary writer and co-creator, and Michael Walsh drew the first issue. So if anybody's familiar with Mike's art, and they're both the nicest guys on the it's funny. And Eamon, who's drawing it now, is super. I'm the meanest guy in the group.
Okay.
like hands down, like I'm the nastiest dude in the group. But the those guys. So Mike and Ryan, Mike drew it and Ryan wrote it ages ago. Like they started this project, and it was one of Mike's first like published projects. And I think something happened with the original publisher, nothing negative. It was just like timing or, you know, reach or I don't know what happened. But sure. Then Michael ended up getting an image book with Ed Brisson. And so Mike had to vacate the book. And so Ryan was like, shoot, I tend to swear. If I don't catch myself, can you just bleep me or whatever?
That's
you
totally
do?
Fine. We leave swears in. It's that kind of podcast.
Okay. Well, like I said, I'm a bit of an, I'm a nasty guy. So you're going to get some nasty words. But the, so they both kind of were like, well, shoot, who's going to take over our duties? And both of them thought of me. So it was like really flattering. I was on Twitter at the time and posting stuff. And so, I got offered the job and I took it, and, you know, Ryan and I wrote and did several issues together. Well, he wrote and I drew several issues. By the time we got to four, like I kind of offered up, I was like, hey, can I rewrite some of this? I think like we'll be able to lead into five a little better. And he was like, yeah, let's go for it. So then I kind of co-wrote some of the end of issue four. I mean, what he had was awesome, but I was kind of nervous about like I wanted to kind of get a slightly bigger cliffhanger in there. So we did a little rewriting on five or four, and then we kind of went on hiatus for quite some time. And then fast forward to now, Ryan is retired from comics. Like I think he has one more unpublished project coming out, but it's been done for a while. Michael, you know, is kind of doing his own thing and kind of has set his own identity. So, you know, I'm not trying to like drag him into his past or anything like that. You know, like, but I tend to, and not that he has anything to be embarrassed of. He's done great work and, you know, all that stuff. But realistically, a lot of this project comes from, I'm kind of like the Brothers James in a way where I don't like to let loose ends just dangle. I called Ryan. I said, hey, how do you feel about finishing the project? We have one issue left. And he said, that's awesome, but I can't write it. Like, I have too much going on. Like, do you want to write it? And I said, absolutely. So we kind of bounced some story just to make sure that we were on the same page, because it had been a couple of years since we had touched on it. And I put together an outline. He thought it was great. I scripted it. We kind of went over it. Everything's good to go. And then in comes Eamon Hill, who's a local guy, tattooer, just like me. We started talking. Eamon was on board. And then since we kind of were off to the races, so to speak. And after that, you know, I kind of reached out to the internet to find out about crowdfunding stuff. And Jordan reached out to me, and we got to talking about, you know, what they had to offer, what their platform offered that maybe Kickstarter or Indiegogo didn't, and this, that, and the other. And it seemed to make sense. So I kind of said, all right, you know, I'm an old punk rock dude. So it was like, well, these guys, you know, are kind of underdogs anyway. Let's go for it. And they've been really great. So we've been working with them and really, really closely working with them, where they kind of handle a lot, you know, communications, et cetera, et cetera. And we're just wrapping up this project. And Ryan and I have revisited the previous four issues too. So there's some tweaks and stuff and minor changes from the original. Like, you saw the final, pretty much the final version of issue two, which is not the same version that came out, you know, years ago.
Got it. Oh, so yeah, let me go back a little and just, who are the names attached to the projects? Because you're kind of like, I mean, I'm going to post them on, you know, obviously on my website, parttimefanboy.com, and it's listed on Zoop and stuff like that. But anybody who's just like directly listening and, you know, maybe picks us up on iTunes or Stitcher or something like that, who, besides yourself, what are the full names of the creators attached?
So the project was like, the whole thing has essentially, up until the very last issue, was written by Ryan Ferrier. And he was kind of the progenating point for the whole project. And then as far as artists go, like, Michael Walsh drew the first issue. And then after Mike had to leave because of his image book, I took over art duties. And so I drew two and three, and then I co-wrote four as well as drawn it or drew it rather. And then issue five, Ryan had to kind of step away from writing duties and kind of move just more into a story capacity, and sort of not editorial, but, you know, like worked around the plot and all that stuff. And then I scripted it. And then Eamon Hill, we brought on to essentially draw it.
Gotcha. And so, I mean, to me, this is interesting because, from what you're brought in, they kind of contact you as like an artist, but then you also become a co-writer, as it moves on, right?
Yeah. And Ryan, I attribute all that to Ryan. Ryan's an extremely deferential person when it comes to working with artists. So he's always kind of like really cool and kind and always willing to hear other people's ideas. And so I kind of had some ideas and we were talking about it. And I was like, what about something like this? And we kind of, and I was kind of like, is it okay if I just kind of write it? Because it's easier for me to write out than it is to you know, like try to describe it. And so he said, sure, yeah, go for it. And so we just ended up using that as the script.
Oh, okay.
So that was kind of how the writing came about, was Ryan just being extremely deferential and awesome and he saw merit in it, so he rolled with it. He was great. He's about as good of a collaborator as anybody could get.
Sure, sure. No, I mean, that must be really cool for you, right? Because, I mean, you're sort of like, people are working on a project and, yeah, I mean, I've seen your art online and it looks beautiful. I've seen like on your website, it's brianlevel.com, correct?
Yeah, I think that is a website that I own. I'm not sure where it directs to. So I had like an art rep shift and stuff. And so there's some like that website was involved in that. Yeah. I generally just kind of have like my catch all for everything I've worked on. And dreamcult.com is usually where I kind of keep all my projects put together. But it's kind of funny because even that gets a little muddy because some of them I write, some of them I draw. I'm a mess, man.
No, I mean, it's totally fine. But to me, it seems like it's really cool. So like, I mean, one of my sort of favorite artists like growing up was John Byrne, right? And you know, I mean, in recent years, it's come, you know, people have had like weird stories and maybe not such a nice person, or maybe he is a nice person. I don't know. But he used to like hate being referred to as like sort of, or he used to refer to himself as the art monkey, right? Like when he wasn't drawing, when he wasn't writing a book, right? So like, and I realize that there's a lot of people who are, you know, can come on as an artist and do whatever they're required. But obviously an artist on a comic also has to add their own flair. So for you, that must have been like really cool. Like did they give you like scripts and stuff like that? Or like, was it just outlines and you were like, hey, this works better if I kind of flesh this out? I'm trying to understand, you know, knowing how comics work, or, you know, sometimes how collaborations work, how, you know, they brought an artist on and it was just like, okay, I'm going to take on some of the writing chores. Am I making any sense with my curiosity on that?
Yeah, sure. I think like that actual point of view of being the art monkey or whatever, I think that's like kind of true, like for a lot of us, not for all of us, of course, but like there is an element of like, if you're, you know, if you don't like, so I've done projects at the Big Two where I've not even communicated with the writer, like not for lack of trying, just just kind of non-responsive or whatever. And I don't say that as an indictment against them. Like that's completely functional. That's why you have editors and all that stuff.
Sure.
But it does kind of make your investment in the story really difficult. And so you kind of either are left with a choice of like just kind of phone it in or give as much effort as you perceive them giving or whatever, or you do what I do, which is just, okay, like I guess I don't care about their opinion, so I'm going to become a psycho and draw things in an insane way. And that's, you know, effectively what I've done on some projects. Now, weirdly, I feel like even though I say that, it still doesn't work as well as when I have the collaborator saying, yes, be a psycho. And then I feel really good to go, you know?
Sure, sure, sure. But I mean, the art of comics, or the making of comics, like especially for something like the Big Two, or if you're on a regular book or there's like a rush and you have to do at least like one page a day. I mean, you know, if you look at somebody like, say, Jack Kirby and stuff like that, doesn't it lend it to, you've got to kind of be that like psycho art, like you've just got to move forward and be like, okay, I've got the script, I've got to interpret it in my own way, and I've got to move forward so that we can get this book out, right?
Well, I think so, but like the way that Jack was given, I guess, story notes versus how we're given story notes is just completely different.
Sure.
You know, like he was given like Marvel style plots where he was able to be exceedingly creative within that space, but also that's mentally demanding. Because you're effectively operating as a writer and a creator and an artist kind of all at the same time. But, you know, like now, you know, you're given full script, which is generally broken down by panel with the dialogue in it and like kind of what's going on, and often shot direction. And that's OK. None of that stuff's a problem for me. But it does make it hard to break away from that in a way, because it's so, there's so much specificity that like you can't, like it is difficult to be kind of to be a little bit nutty with your choices when you know that, okay, like everybody has to be over here in the next panel or over here in the next panel.
Sure.
So you can't kind of go as nuts. So I think there is a little bit, you know, the Star Wars thing I did was where I probably was like, I don't care if I get fired.
Oh, really?
The most on that project, just because I said no to it at first. And then I slept on it and I was like, you know what, I'll do it. Because I didn't want to get like micromanaged by, like when I say get micromanaged by Lucasfilm, that was like a presumption on my part, not a reality. Like I just assumed I would be getting micromanaged by Lucas. And so I kind of just didn't want to deal with that, being a big giant baby and a capital A artist. Like a, I say that with like a kind of a, like making fun of myself.
Sure.
I was just like, I don't want to deal with this corporate stuff. And then the next day, my wife and I talked about it, and she was like, you know, Mark, like that, my editor, that book had been through a lot of iterations and a lot of, there was some drama online about like,
what book was that?
It was Darth Vader, Dark Visions. Yeah. And then, there was some, like, I got asked to do it. I said no. And then I came back the next day and I said, okay, that's fine. Cause like Mark asked me to sleep on it. And so I did. And I decided to do it, but I was like, you know what, if I'm going to do it, like, I'm going to have a wild, fun time with it. And,
sure.
And I did. And, you know, like, much to my chagrin, like, Lucas had no notes that were, like they were totally cool and let me do whatever I wanted. Literally, the one note I got was, like, me turning – I turned into a total jock about it because they were like – you know, like these ships are like 900 meters long and these ships are like 1700 meters long and the scale seems off. And I was just kind of like, you nerds, like who cares about these shit, you know, like these stupid ships. But I was totally wrong. You know, like I was, you know, I didn't say that to anybody, but I like felt that like, I don't want to change these. Why do nerds care so much about this? When it's like, dude, you're just as much of a nerd as anybody else. Like you're just being a baby because, you know, like you're just being protective and egoist. And so I was like, yeah, that's a good note. So I think
that's funny. So you were waiting for your like turning over the table moment and it kind of never really came. You were waiting for like the whole like my art, you know, and it kind of, sure. I mean, it happened a little bit, but not really.
And ultimately they're what, like, I think that's a big lie, like in the self in general, is that like people are always against you. Like, I think it's like when you're posed defensively, like you just read everything through the worst possible lens.
Sure.
And so you know, it's in, like I got like I was that way through that whole project. And that's not anybody's fault but my own, like in a problem with my own sort of ego and my own everything. And, you know, you get to the end of it. And you do a good job. And the work I did was good. Like, I'm not saying like I, you know, it made my work suffer. Like I did good work. There was, you know, spite had its own, you know, had its own benefit, I guess. But simultaneously, like such a stupid, toxic way for me to be, really.
Sure. No, well, a lot of artists are like that. We're very defensive about our work, you know, when we draw, and, you know, and it takes a lot. I mean, I don't think people realize like how much emotional, sometimes physical, you know, energy goes into creating pages for comics or even anything, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think like I had to learn like how also like, yes, we're defensive, but what are we defensive of? And the thing that we're defensive of, I think, is our ego. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think we spin that into we're defensive of our paycheck, because if people don't respond well, then we don't get, you know, then we don't eat.
Sure.
But I think half of that is a lie. I think that's a justification for egoism. So I think there's definitely truth to it, but I don't think that that's the truth.
You know? Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, going back and redoing things can be hard sometimes. So, and it's not.
Yeah, especially when you're underpaid on a tight schedule.
Yeah, or not working digitally, right? Like, it's like I have to go back and, you know, I mean, if you're working in a digital file, it could be a lot easier to maybe fix those ships, right? But if you were drawing them, you know, on an actual, you know, comic book page, that would suck, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, you know, weirdly, it depends on the scenario. I've had some moments where I just kind of trace right over top of with a piece of computer paper over top of the panel and do like a brush pen like patch, and it's way faster than getting into a computer, because when I get in the computer, I find myself noodling, you know?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, I totally understand what you're saying. Yes, yes. No. Well, let's talk about the brothers James. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the people involved and how you came to be involved, but what is the book about? I mean, when I read that second issue, it reminded me a little bit more of like a hardcore sort of like, you know, and I don't know if this is complimentary or not, like sort of like a supernatural kind of vibe, which I'm not really a big fan of the show. I've never watched a lot of it. I'm not disparaging it in any way, but it's kind of like two brothers. They're on the road. They're kind of like on a mission. Would you say that that's kind of accurate in a way? I mean, supernatural without the supernatural in a way.
Yeah. So I think that a lot of comparison that's drawn to Supernatural is completely fair. And I can't really speak to the character designs, but like they definitely lend themselves toward that too.
Sure.
So like Jack and John definitely resemble Sam and Dean, and Henrietta, our Challenger, is not too far off from their car. So there's, you know, and it's a road trip book, so I totally get the comparison. I think for Ryan and everybody involved, we were kind of looking at it more like, you know, kind of more like exploitation cinema, like 70s road movies, you know, like Easy Rider or, you know, like stuff like that, like kind of like what you would get with like big, silly, like voiceovers in the trailers that rule.
Yeah.
Something you'd see at a grindhouse theater. And so like I think the aesthetics there, what you're talking about, and even some like light, like the familial aspects and all that are very like comparable to Supernatural. But for me, it's like we're talking biker gangs, we're talking like blood cults, like you know, that, like we're talking like people getting beer bottles broken over their face. Like it's a little less a lot less Supernatural.
Yeah, no. I mean, I was just speaking in a very sort of like superficial way. You know what I mean?
I think you're totally right.
Yeah. And I mean, it is very, I mean, I was reading this, there's another creator who did like a biker book that I interviewed and it was called Mayfield 8 and he was doing Kickstarter stuff. And this is, and he loved like the grindhouse biker, like all that stuff as well. So this is definitely, this is in that wheelhouse where it's like biker flicks. And I mean, you said Easy Rider. I think this is more like, I mean, I don't, you know, I don't know the titles of a lot of like biker flicks, but it, like you said, it is like a grindhouse feel. It is very edgy. It is very violent. It's, you know, it's kind of witty and interesting in that way. I'm assuming that you're a fan of those sort of things.
Yeah. And I think almost more than like some of those biker movies, like I work in a tattoo shop. So like, I just know a lot of bikers.
Sure.
And so like I've owned a tattoo shop for, it'll be 10 years in April.
Oh, wow.
And, if there's one thing that I've grown to appreciate is the diversity of personality in actual bikers. And I love 70s movies.
Sure.
You know, I like Dennis Hopper a lot. So, you know, Easy Rider is like an obvious like thing to like, but I think the aesthetics of exploitation movies for me, and the real life, like just kind of tattoo shop experience was more informative for me. And my dad, weirdly, he runs a performance engine shop. So I've been around muscle cars my whole life.
Oh, that's cool.
So I was a pretty good fit for the project.
What's the name of your shop?
My tattoo shop is called Illuminaut Tattoo, Illuminaut.
Where is
Illuminati,
it?
Which is, it's in Ludlow, Kentucky.
Nice.
It's just over the river. So that's another thing. I'm in Kentucky. So I guess I'm pretty close to the South where, you know, where the book takes place. There's a serendipitous pick for me to be on the book.
Sure. Sure. So, yeah, no, I mean, so when you were approached with this and you saw what it was, were you just like, yeah, right on. I'm all in.
Yeah. And weirdly, like I had already kind of become aware of the project because I was a fan of Michael's and Ryan's.
Uh-huh.
And so like when they asked me, it wasn't even like a mystery. I already liked the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of a nice thing to find.
Sure. Well, I mean, talk to me about the history of the book. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, I said a nice job to get, I should say.
Sure. Sure. No, but I mean, I was very interested as well in the sort of history of the book. Because, I mean, quite frankly, I had not ever heard of it. And, you know, whether, again, there's a lot of things that I don't hear about. I'm a dad and, you know, busy with my own things sometimes. But it seems to me like you had mentioned earlier, this was sort of a project that got started and, you know, helped launch some careers in comics and then didn't get finished and kind of like sat around for a while. And now you've decided to finish it, right?
Correct. Yeah, I think it suffers maybe is the wrong term, but I don't know. Like a lot of indie books, you know, when I talk about this project, I'm going to try to exclude myself, but, you know, I guess if the shoe fits, I'll wear it.
Sure.
You know, a lot of skilled creators, people that show promise, this happens all the time. They start indie books, but they don't finish them because they start getting job options because the indie books, you know, get attention.
Yeah.
And then that attention then garners the attention of editorial at other companies, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
And so these books that people labor away on for peanuts or for nothing or lose money on, then they start to get opportunities where they can actually get paid and support themselves and fulfill their dream. And that's essentially what happened to this book. You know, Mike and Ed got a book picked up at Image Shadowline, Valentino's imprint.
Oh, wow.
And then Ryan and I worked on it, and I started getting like Comeback was what like kind of what was responsible for me getting. So if you ever read Ed and Mike's Comeback, that was kind of why I got the job on Brothers James, was because of Comeback. And then okay. I worked on Comeback, or I worked on, we call Brothers James Bro Jams affectionately.
Okay.
I started working on Bro Jams on issue two. And I think I worked on that from two, three, and four. But by the time issue three ended, I started getting inking jobs. I had kind of put myself online a bit, and Stefano Godiano, who is an amazing inker who's worked on, you know, like he worked over Charlie Abbott on Walking Dead for years and Michael Lark for a decade. So he and I were like, I kind of worked and filled in for him on spots, and I started getting inking jobs at Valiant when they relaunched. And then I took over for him on Lazarus over Michael. And so I was doing Brothers James and doing inking work. And then eventually Ed and I, weirdly, Ed Brisson, step in again, my man, he and I had a book picked up at Image Shadowline as well called The Mantle. And that's kind of what put the brakes on Brothers James, was me kind of getting gigs as a penciler finally in comics.
So how was the Brothers James coming out before, you know, Zoop? I mean, was it coming out like issue one came out and then issue two, was it being sold at conventions? Was it online? Was it was through a publisher? Or like, it sounds like it got to issue three and then stopped, and issue four you wanted to finish, right? And because you don't like leaving stuff like dangling. But how was the book coming out prior to Zoop?
Well, I think, and if I get any of this wrong, if somebody has better information, forgive me. But issue one, I believe, was originally slated to come out through 215 Inc., which is a East Coast publisher. They're small. They handled all kinds of great indie books at the time. Like they put out Ed Brisson's first stuff, Black River. They put out, I believe, this issue one. And then they also put out, I think Jeremy Holt had a book there at one point or another. There was all kinds of people that I was, because I was like, oh, this is like a new publisher of really promising creators. Alex Diotto put out a book there. I mean, there's just, you know, great people coming out of 215. And then Mike left. And I think that's when the book kind of was like, well, we don't know what to do. So then I got brought on. And so I think 215 released it a little bit, but then I think that after Mike left, the kind of contract maybe no longer functioned or something.
Sure.
So then it just became self-published. Ryan ended up, and I can't take any credit for this, I don't believe, but we ended up kind of intermingling and working on it together, started a online sort of like comic imprint called Read Challenger. And so Challenger was essentially where we put out the Brothers James, was through his sort of solo imprint, which also functioned as a place to do, we were putting up short comics from other creators online for people to read for free. So it was kind of like our little experimenting with short comics and stuff like that. And then years went by and the book kind of fizzled out because of time. By issue four was finished, issue five was the last issue, and we just never got to it.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. And so on Zoop, it's the whole series, right? It's one through five, correct? I mean, it's complete.
Yep. You got it. It's the book is like the art's being finished now. So it's issues one through five, two through four were drawn by me. Issue one, still drawn by Mike. Ryan written one through four. I wrote five, but all the issues are available. It's a very cohesive project. I'm really like proud of it, you know, like,
sure,
like as a guy to like look back at what was done all those years ago, like we still, Ryan and I went back to it and we're like, this is a pretty fucking good comic book. you know, like it's pretty exciting. There's not a ton of stuff on the market like it. And probably because I don't know how many people want a sort of Southern fried revenge story about bros.
I think there's a lot of people that like that. I mean, it's funny because I am very much, I mean, I still like superheroes. I love indie comics. I love all kinds of comics, but I definitely cut my teeth on the men in tights, you know, men and women in tights. And, but I definitely love something like this. I think there's not enough of like this type of like grown up sort of like violent revenge thriller in comics, right?
Yeah, I think at some point or another, like, comics is so built around the absurd in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I love that about it.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, when we start getting into, like, these gritty, like, earthy, like, places you can go in real life tales, I think then there's this proclivity toward, like, telling the story in a grounded way.
Uh-huh.
And Ryan and I just never had any interest in that. And that's why I think it actually functioned so well as a comic, was because we took an earthy reality, or this world that these guys live in, and we were just like, fuck it, man, let's make it nuts. And so we did. You know, we just tried to make a bonkers book that was set in the real world, like, where stuff kind of can't happen this way, but, like, enough so that you believe it. It's just a wild, you know, we just tried to do the grindhouse thing, which is, you know, when a guy gets shot with a shotgun in a grindhouse movie, there a hole gets blown in them. Like,
yeah,
like, that's absurd. That's absurd and impossible, but it makes for a cool movie. And so we were kind of trying to think of, like, what does comics do that, you know, that, like, that can make this thing work, you know? And so we try to do that with panel layouts. We try to do it with, you know, all kinds of different stuff.
Sure. No, I mean, just how crazy does it get? Because, I mean, I read the second issue and, you know, again, I very much liked it. And I was like, oh, this is cool. But, I mean, it seemed like, for an adventure book, like, pretty grounded, you know, like, there's violence and there's fights and things like that. Like, nothing super crazy happened to me in that book, but I'm assuming in other issues, like, what are we getting? More violent, more absurd with the violence, more kind of crazy with the action? Is there something that somebody like me, who is interested in the project, I mean, I don't want to say look forward to, because obviously I look forward to it anyway, having read that issue and liked it, but does it go more bonkers as it goes on?
I mean, it's like any good drag race, like the cars just go faster and faster. we don't take the pedal off the gas at all.
Uh-huh.
Even the moments where it feels like there's like a slowdown for emotional stuff, like, there's crazy shit happening, like, in that moment.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, yes, it gets crazier, but I kind of feel like you as a guy who's kind of like, it feels pretty grounded. It all is in the real world. It just kind of feels like, I'm a firm believer that I can't write anything crazier than what happens in real life.
Sure.
I just don't believe I can. Like, I've tried, you know, and it's like, and then you read a story and you're like, what in the hell? Like, that happened? Oh my God. Like, that sounds fake.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of have hit that point where I'm like, I'm just going to write stuff one of the most obnoxious. So I'm just going to lay this out there. One of the most obnoxious things is when everything is like this perfectly like a perfect watch on a book that's supposed to be exciting. Like, and unless like the whole point of the book is to be that perfectly like timed watch, like, I kind of feel like it actually works against the emotional sort of drive of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
For us, like, we tried to like take this thing, like, everything fits together, but it fits together like a machine that you build at home out of spare parts, and the machine works, but it's not like a perfectly machined watch where everything is like this perfectly ticking. You know, I just don't really tend to prefer things that feel like perfectly machined watches.
Sure.
I tend to prefer things that feel cobbled together, but still do their job. You know, yeah. I always kind of joke like horror to me works best when it feels like a car where the accelerator can't stop pushing down and the wheels are about to fall off and you're heading toward a cliff. And like anything short of that is not scary.
Sure.
And I think the same thing goes with a lot of storytelling, is it doesn't have to be quite so janky or wobbly, but I still try to keep that like accelerator, Clive Barker referred to it as moving big stones in fast water. Like, so there's big ideas being pushed through fast water. So we do some weird shit. There's issue 5 that I wrote is probably the weirdest events.
Uh-huh.
And I would say probably require the most suspension of disbelief. But I also think that those things that I do in it are also the funnest.
Yeah.
Ryan and I are different writers. So you do get like, there isn't a tonal difference. There's just kind of like a natural psychotic progression that happens from issue 1 to issue 5, where if you look at it as a whole story, you're just like, oh, whoa, like this car is going faster and faster and faster and holy shit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, I kind of want to compliment you guys in a way, because reading that second issue, when I, you know, I read the second issue and I was like, oh, is this like, I mean, it was very much like beginning, middle and end to that issue. Right. And that's something that you don't sort of get in like modern comics. Like things have changed in a bit where it's, you know, there's all this talk of like, I don't know if it's still being talked about, like writing for the trade. And, you know, when you used to read a comic, you would get like an issue and you could be like, and the second issue, at least for me, you know, when I read it, I was like, oh, is this kind of like an anthology? But then, you know, I got to the end and it's like, oh, okay. It seems like it's going to be continued. Can you speak to that aspect of the storytelling? Because it seemed very, you know, kind of tight and well managed, not, you know, ticking like a clock or anything like you said, but it very well like was its own story. Is each chapter or each issue like them completing sort of like a mission that they're going on, and it's part of a larger arc of the five issues? Am I making any sense with that question?
Yes, you're making sense, and yes, it does. Each issue is very episodic in a way. Like to us, it's like the Brothers James is a record, and every issue is a song.
Sure.
So like it's like we feel like the issues are satisfying in their own right while also build on the whole.
Sure, sure. And I mean, as far as, you know, the five issues are concerned, I mean, if this Zoop project funds and stuff like that, are you kind of done with the Brothers James, or is that like a world you'd like to revisit in the future if things are, or, you know, are you just too busy with other projects and stuff?
There's like, we've brainstormed a little bit, like if we continued it, but I think both of us are most satisfied, especially by the time you get to the end of the story. I feel like there's really when Ryan and I kind of put the plot together for the final issue to make sure everything was going to be wrapped up. Like we wrapped it up in a bow where I feel like if we never, you know, like definitely we could continue if we really wanted to, but I feel like we have a nice satisfying arc for all of our characters in a way that, well, all the ones that deserve satisfying arcs, I feel like. The ones that don't deserve it, they don't get it, you know?
Sure, sure, sure. So, yeah, I mean, as somebody who's made sort of their, like, revenge grindhouse thriller, you know, action movie, I mean, you mentioned Easy Rider before, but do you have like another favorite that other people might not have heard of? It sounds like you're a fan of like 70s films and stuff like that. What is like if somebody says biker movie to you or revenge thriller or something like that, what pops into your head? I would imagine it sounds like you're a fan of film.
Yeah, I am. I almost don't even necessarily have like a road movie that I would recommend as much as just the energy that I try to put into stuff. I would recommend stuff from Abel Ferrara.
Okay.
You know, like Driller Killer is kind of like his first feature that everybody kind of recognizes because it's an insane slasher movie. But Miss 45, if you've got the stomach for it, is a great, great, great revenge movie. You know, Bad Lieutenant with Harvey Keitel is incredible. Just an incredible movie. And I feel like if you've read The Brothers James and you've seen Harvey Keitel, Bad Lieutenant, like it's like a new, like even though it's New York, it still has similar energy, you know?
Sure.
And I think that Abel Ferrara is probably the closest thing. Like the dude just makes psychotic movies.
Yeah.
So if I was gonna actually look at like a comic book, I would say kind of if I was going to compare comic book wise, like I love Stray Bullets.
Oh,
like,
God.
Stray Bullets to me is like the comic book. Stray Bullets is like one of the best. And I think that's another reason that we actually didn't try to color it for the Zoop campaign, because that was like a thing we considered was coloring it and kind of re-releasing it as a color book.
Yeah.
But Stray Bullets is a black and white. And we're like, well, if it's good enough for Stray Bullets, it's good enough for us.
No, Stray Bullets. Is it David Lampum? Is that how you pronounce his last name? Or Lampum? Like that.
Yeah. Lapham.
Yeah. I remember, I had the hardcovers like when they first came out, and I remember reading those books and just being like, what is this? Like I had not really, I think at that age been exposed to that sort of like storytelling, like very human, very down to earth, but also sort of like edge of your seat. And like, you know, what is going to happen? Right.
Right. Oh, totally. You know, actually, if I'm thinking more in comic terms too, like I'm a huge fan, and so is Eamon, of EC crime books.
Oh, yeah.
Like crime suspense stories and shock suspense stories and those sort of things. Crime Patrol. Like, so I think there's some of that creeped in there. Some of the like manic sort of angles and approaches to things. And I think I bought the trade. I think it's called Reckless. Brubaker and Sean Phillips did that, like, graphic novel recently. It's like a graphic novel series. It's like set like 70s grindhousey stuff, but I haven't got to read my copy yet.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah, no, that was one of the things I wanted to ask too, is like, why did you keep it in black and white? And obviously black and white is sort of less expensive to publish, but as an homage to, or a tribute to something like Stray Bullets, or looking at something like that, it totally makes sense.
But, you know, it's funny, like when I was doing the covers for the new issues, I colored them and then I did black and white versions. And I actually think I prefer the black and white versions. There's just something about black and white that feels weirdly always subversive, no matter what.
Yeah.
And I think it just fits the tone of the book, is it's kind of it's not a super subversive book, but I think in a market that doesn't want those type of books, really, then it's just naturally subversive by its own existence.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I have to say that, like I said earlier, I mean, I read that second issue and I was like, I'm in. I mean, I'm going to go to Zoop and fund it. I mean, one of the things I wanted to ask about, I mean, I'm assuming you grew up in Kentucky, or you grew up in that area of the country?
I did not. I grew up in northern Ohio, up against the Great Lakes near Toledo.
Oh, okay.
Sandusky.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, I guess my question would be, how did you get into comics? I mean, it sounds like you've been into them for a long time. How did you decide you wanted to become an artist? Like, how did that sort of thing, how did you just get grabbed by the craziness that is the comic book?
You know, well, I guess I've always read them, you know, like I've always read comics since I was a kid. And, you know, I've had my stints of reading them and not reading them, and, you know, buying them and not buying them, depending on money and availability, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
But it was like 2009 was where I wanted to start like kind of making comics again. And I worked with an old friend of mine on a couple of like indie, like short story things. And then I just kind of couldn't stop doing it, because it was, you know, working as a tattooer. I've been a tattooer almost 20 years.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow.
And, you know, you kind of spend a lot of time only drawing for other people. And so the comic book was something good for me, because I was able to kind of flex maybe all of my artistic muscles in the way that I wanted to flex them without anybody's feedback or anybody's concern. Like, it was just all for me. And so it was more artistic expression. And, you know, I started posting stuff because I was excited by the process, and made friends with Stefano Godiano because I was such a huge fan of Gotham Central.
Oh, yeah.
And I just kind of reached out to him on Facebook because I saw he was on there, and I was like, just DM'd him, like, say, hey, man, like, just a huge fan. Like, I love what you did on Gotham Central. I love what you did on Daredevil. Like, those issues where you worked on X, Y, like, cause I was always been a fan of inkers.
Sure.
And what they brought to the table. And he kind of hit me back after a couple of days, and we started talking, and he was asking me about my art that I was posting. I was posting some panels from stuff I was dicking around on. Yeah. And he really liked it. And he was like, who do you work anywhere? Like, do you want to work anywhere? And then he was like, I tend to take about 30%, more work than I can handle, so that way I can contract it out and keep everybody busy and keep myself busy.
Oh.
So if you're ever interested in working, you know, like, we can kind of test you out on some stuff and see if it works. And I said, absolutely. And so I was very fortunate to have Stefano offer me some work, and I ended up, you know, helping relaunch Valiant in 2012, working over at Manuel Garcia on Bloodshot and
really?
On Harbinger. Yeah. I did finishes over Barry Kitson on, Harbinger. So I did a lot of stuff over there. I didn't start getting credited right away because they had to run me through the system, and Stefano pitched a fit about it. Nothing. And that wasn't like Valiant's fault. That was just a contractual thing. Like, they were really good to me.
Yeah.
And, Stefano is just better to me is all.
Well, I loved I love what Valiant has been doing, and that early stuff. I mean, those were some of the books
awesome.
That I would just pick up in trades and just be like, I mean, I wasn't in the 90s. I was not into Valiant at all. There were just only so many comics I could buy when I was,
right.
You know, younger. And, but like the resurfacing of Valiant was something that I was just like really fascinated by. And it's funny because Bloodshot was one of those books that I thought that it seemed a little bit more of like a Punisher type of thing when I first picked it up. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this. And then I just ended up loving it. I was just like, oh, this is great.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty nonstop, like super actiony, really fun book.
Yeah.
Who was Dwayne Swierczynski, I think, wrote that?
Yeah, I do not know off the top of my head. I cannot recall. All I can recall is that I thought that they were great. Like, I was just like, this is great stuff. And, you know, the EXO Manowar, like all that stuff. I had not really, I mean, I knew generally speaking what they were, but I had, I did not know like the granular detail. So I was being introduced to something brand new and I was just like, oh, this is great, you know?
Right.
It's great.
Yeah, I mean, they were just, they did a great job of kind of like that whole line was well curated. The people I got to ink over there was crazy. Like I said, Barry Kitson, Manuel Garcia. I worked over Luis La Rosa, who is just unbelievable, like unbelievable talent. So yeah, I worked over all kinds of folks over there. And then eventually I had to leave because Stefano got asked to work on Lazarus, Michael Lark, Greg Rucka book.
Uh-huh.
And he at the same time got offered to ink Charlie Adler on The Walking Dead.
Oh, wow.
And so he was like, Michael, I can't do this because I'm like, Walking Dead's going to take me multiple years. And it's good, consistent work, but I have this guy, Brian, who might be a good fit, you know? And so Michael was like, well, cool, let's try him out. So he handed over like six pages of issue 3, and Stefano and I split the pages 3 and 3. And he kind of gave him, you know, he turned him into Michael. And Michael's like, cool, which ones are his? And he's like, if you can't tell, he's got the job.
Oh, wow.
And so he, you know, I got the job. So I worked over like as Michael's sort of inking assistant from issues 3 through 11.
Gotcha. Yeah, no. And so would you say you started off like in comics, like as an inker? Because I mean,
absolutely.
Looking at your work online, you know, that site that I pointed out earlier, BrianLevel.com. I mean, as to whether you want to promote that or not, it has some of your beautiful artwork on there. And I mean, it seems like you're very, I mean, there's a lot of like really nice, like ink washes or ink, you know, like deep and dark inks. And that's sort of like the look of this book as well. I mean, can you speak to your art style or your influences?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a huge Dave Laughlin fan, of course.
Yeah.
And Frank Robbins is another guy I love. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He did The Shadow back forever ago. So I'm a big Frank Robbins fan. Johnny Craig. Like obviously everybody likes Darwin Cook. Like I'm very brushy guys.
What about
like.
Paul Pope? Are you a fan of his?
You know, weirdly, everybody's a fan of Paul Pope, but he's not an influence of mine at all.
Okay.
I think his stuff is so like beyond me. Like I'm more of a structuralist, you know?
Gotcha.
And I think his stuff is so wild. Like I admire it deeply, but I struggle to learn from it in a way. I don't compute the same way. But I'm also a huge fan of Guy Davis.
Oh, okay.
Guy Davis is like just a god to me. And so like, it's funny, like you'll see which thing I lean into depending on the project, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Go for it, bro. No. I was just saying like your work is very detailed and like very, very, I mean, it's interesting. There's like an intense, particularly on those pinups that I saw, I was like, wow, this guy is like intense. Like he must really just dive deep into it.
Yeah. So that's funny. I think that you're probably looking at some commissions. Is that about
right? Yeah. It says commissions.
So. So that's kind of a funny, like to me, comics and commissions are different disciplines.
Sure.
So when I show up to a commission, I try to think about like, okay, how can I, so like, there's like multiple versions of me. And I don't mean that like Mike, like there's Mike Norton who he can do anything. That guy's a crazy genius. Like he can produce any kind of work, it seems.
Sure.
Yeah. Like Mike Norton can produce almost anything. Like it's insane. He's so good.
Yeah.
But for me, like I've got about three modes. I've got commission mode, which is to do insanely detailed, like big bulky figures where I'm really drawing a lot from like my fandom of Joe Quesada and John Romita Jr. Versus like when I make comics, like I'm kind of looking at it more from like depending on if it's a superhero comic, I'm looking a little bit more wild influences. But if I'm doing a crime comic, then I'm looking at like my horror and crime references, you know, like Lapham or like I said, Johnny Craig or Graham Ingalls or somebody like that. So the detail thing is kind of funny. Like sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. But on commissions, it's always there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just looking at those and it seemed like it was a site for commissions and, you know, for people to contract commissions. And, you know, one of the thing that I saw on the page was, it said something like backgrounds are subject to the artists or, and a lot of times you see commissions and it's like they charge like, hey, just figure, hey, background. And I was like, if this dude is choosing to draw these amazing backgrounds, like, that's fantastic. Because, like, they all had backgrounds. And I'm like, if he's choosing to do that, like, that is insane. Like, it's just amazing.
Well, thanks. So weirdly, like the way, like that's maybe my older, I don't know if that's like, if that was the Inky Knuckles site or if that was the Brian Level site. So yeah, so Cam, you know, like there's my commission setup is like, if you're looking at like a big 11 by 17 or whatever, like that's generally like what's considered a cover quality commission. So like, I will just dump it all on the page there. Like there is no discretion there. Like I just go insane. Like that's like my top tier commission. So you might be seeing some of those, but like there might be like nine by 12s where someone's like, I want a Daredevil 9x12. And then maybe I'll throw in a rooftop or I'll throw in like a water tower, just something to ground it or whatever.
Got it. Got it. No, that's great.
I love drawing that stuff. It just sometimes it takes forever. So you're like, you know, I got to move on and I don't have to be doing this.
Yeah. It looks like it takes forever to me too. I was looking at it and I was like, man, this is great. Those people got their money's worth.
Well, I'm glad that if people feel that way, that makes me happy.
Well, I'm just looking at it online and I feel that way. I'm like, those people got their damn money's worth. I was like, he is not messing around. Like, that's good
stuff.
That's
a really funny distinction too, to make, that you're looking at it online, because I do so many washes and layers. I do like white paint and I like carve stuff out. Like I take razor blades to the work a lot.
Oh, wow.
So it's funny because the product that you see online is so much different than holding it in your hand. Like the piece in your hand is so much more textural.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, just the other day I posted something on like just this little Green Goblin drawing that I was just doing for fun. And, you know, I took a picture of it and then I also scanned it and I'm like, it just looks so much better in person, you know, and I'm not on the level of artistry or have the time to devote to detail that someone like you does, because mostly for me, it's like these days hobby stuff, right? But I was just like, man, this must have taken, like, I can look at that and just be like, and I can imagine seeing it in person and just being even more blown away by it, you know?
Well, thank you.
Well, in any case, I mean, the project is called The Brothers James. Any final thoughts on this, like before we sign off and, you know, you can go back to your life and not have to deal with my annoying questions anymore.
Bro, you've been awesome. I just appreciate people, you know, having any interest in what we're doing at all. Because frankly, like, we're not entitled to the attention in any capacity in a world full of super talented people.
But you are. Don't really say stuff like that. I hate it when artists say stuff, especially like somebody of your caliber. I mean, you know, I did not know of your work before this, but looking at those commissions pages, yeah, you are entitled. I hate that stuff. Artists are entitled. People should, I mean, you know, don't be the entitled jerk that's like walking around, but you know, I'm sorry to get on you like this, but you know, you're an artist. People should look at your work. People should. I mean, you are very talented, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. As somebody who looked at your work and who considers himself, you know, a hobbyist and artist himself, like, I looked at your stuff and I was just like, this is good stuff. It's deserving of an audience. Don't say stuff like that. I just chastise you on my podcast. I apologize.
It's okay. You're allowed to. I'm a big boy. I can handle it.
I understand what you're saying.
I appreciate you saying that. I think maybe, and I think fundamentally, maybe we disagree on this. I don't think anybody has to look at what I do, but I will say that because they don't have to look at what I do, I'm extremely grateful that they do.
Sure.
And the fact that you gave me time to talk about it means a lot to me. I hope that when people show up at the project, or look at the thing, to know that like we did give it everything that we had. Like we dumped in a lot of ourselves, a lot of our ability, a lot of our time, and a lot of our hearts. So, and I don't mean that in like some sort of superficial way. Like Ryan and I became kind of best friends through the process. Like,
sure.
We just, like, it's cool to fall in love with somebody when you work with them.
Yeah.
So it's like a really beautiful thing. And so I'm really grateful for that, to have a friend like Ryan.
Yeah.
So I hope that people can read the book and feel that and sense that, and, you know, also get a lot of bloodshed along the way.
All I have to say, Brian, is I appreciate you taking the time to come onto my podcast. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. And I appreciate the Brothers James, which is on Zoop, and people should go. It's zoop.com, I believe, right? And
Zoop.gg.
Oh, Zoop.gg. Excuse me. Zoop.gg. Look for the Brothers James. Throw your money at it, or else they will come and steal it from you. They're not like that type of, but what's that?
I'm going to show up at your house with a shotgun. I'm going to do some donuts in the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, let's not do that. But the Brothers James might. Again, the Brothers James on Zoop, the artist is Brian Level. Go check it out. I promise you, if you are a fan of like Vengeance, Grindhouse, or just good comics, you will enjoy it. I've only read the second issue and I want to read more. Again, my name is Christian Horn and this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening. Go check out Zoop. Go check out the Brothers James. And we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing. Oh yeah, doing part-time. Oh yeah, doing part-time. Oh yeah, doing part-time. Oh yeah, doing part-time. Part-timefanboy.com.